I want to thank the many people who make the reading series at VCU possible, and that includes Virginia Commonwealth University's library system, Barnes & Noble, the College of Humanities and Sciences, and especially our dean, Allison Baskey, and the Department of English. Also, tonight's reading is being recorded and probably will be published very shortly in Blackbird, our online literary journal, and you can look for it there. And before it's available, you can look at the many other readings that are available there. It is my tremendous pleasure to introduce Gregory Kimbrell tonight, and so I'm just going to launch directly into that. Often when we use the word liminality to describe a poet's aesthetic, we are setting up an audience for an experience of some kind of linguistic experimentation. Sometimes we're talking about language that functions in that fluid space between meaning and a nearly nonsensical delight in play. But the term liminality actually comes to us from anthropology. Here's the Wikipedia definition. You go right to the most reliable source. In anthropology, liminality, from the Latin word limen, meaning a threshold, is the quality of ambiguity or disorientation that occurs in the middle stage of rituals, when participants no longer hold their previous ritual status, but have not yet begun the transition to the status they will hold when the ritual is complete. During a ritual's liminal stage, participants stand at the threshold between their previous way of structuring their identity, time, or community, and a new way, which the ritual establishes. More recently, the usage of the term has broadened to describe political and cultural change as well as rituals. During liminal periods of all kinds, social hierarchies may be reversed or temporarily dissolved. Continuity of tradition may become uncertain, and future outcomes, once taken for granted, may be thrown into doubt. The dissolution of order during liminality creates a fluid, malleable situation that enables new institutions and customs to become established. The term has also passed into popular usage, and it is applied much more broadly today. But it's this kind of anthropological liminality, ritual or even mythological, social and political liminality that is so quirkily in evidence in Gregory Kimbrell's poems. It is this interest in eccentric characters positioned at various thresholds that enables his work to inhabit other forms of in-betweenness. The generic landscape between narrative and lyric, the metaphysical perspective between realism and surrealism, and a tone that walks the line between gravity and camp. Gregory's poems are vignettes with their elegantly, seemingly Victorian diction and Bronte-esque settings that give us an it's good to please the reader that give us an entrance into moments of profound dailiness that are often not only freighted with loss and violence, but also haunted by something like an apocalyptic vision. If what we want from poems is a collision with complexity, these poems are truly remarkable in their achievement of precisely that, as they evoke in their readers both a shudder and a grin, for we find them as disarming as they are disturbing. By couching his meditations in what it means to live at the brink, in a style that calls to mind something like fairy tales for adults, Gregory has given us a beautifully crafted window into our own terrifying confrontations with what it means to live in this 21st century moment of radical political, social, economic, and spiritual unknowing. We too are at a threshold in which our past rituals seem both urgent and sacred, yet also potentially not only ineffective, but mildly ridiculous. In poem after poem, we encounter characters, some of whom recur in such extreme circumstances as plague and war, in an atmosphere that evokes the shift from feudalism to industry. who are attempting to fabricate the meaning of their shattered lives the way Galen, one of the characters in the closing poem of the collection, The Coming Winter, having burned his family estate to the ground after the death of his father and brother, now spends his days in a rented room in the village, stitching toy animals from the remnants of soiled, used clothing. Ultimately, these poems remind us that our lives are inevitably shaped by forces, some graspable and overt, others nearly wholly mysterious and random, far beyond our individual control. As we act out our lives at the nexus of such intersecting powers and our own sense of our own free will, we inevitably confront the central human desire for a perspective or informing narrative larger than our own. In a poem, The Wall, which reads to me like an Ars Poetica, the pilgrim speaker proclaims in the final stanza, "I have begged the wall to open, to acknowledge in me my ancestors. I have begged for a traveler to meet me and say, better awaits, or turn back. That way leads to the cliffs where ancient boulders fall in straits that only the dead could hope to navigate. But no traveler comes. The wall does not open. The kestrels dive and pluck young rabbits from their invisibility. My ancestors hide themselves like this, I tell myself. I simply cannot see them. But no, I have a wall. What I want are legends." Gregory was one of the first students that I met when I came to VCU. It was a rare gift to work with him, and it is a joy to still have him in our lives. He is the events and programs coordinator for the VCU libraries. Please welcome Gregory Kimbrell.
Thank you, Kathy. Can I get a copy of that? I'd like to study it. Thank you, everyone, for being here. It's exciting to read in the Scott House. I see a lot of familiar faces, and a lot of you know me as the events coordinator for the libraries. It's not often I'm on this side of the podium, so it's sort of strange looking out like this and not lurking in the back where I'd usually be, where Tom DiDotto is. Hey, Tom. I will preface this reading by saying that, first of all, this is the first reading I've done in support of this book. Thank you very much, VCU. And for those of you who are not familiar with my particular tastes as a writer, I'll say that all of the poems in this book, as Kathy suggested, are a sort of hybrid of period drama and horror. And that's less the sort of contemporary Saw torture porn horror and more that made in the 70s in Europe on a strict budget and dubbed into English movie variety. So be on the lookout for that in these poems. And if I had to dedicate this reading to anyone, I might dedicate it, for instance, to Paul Naschy, who played the werewolf in all those Spanish werewolf movies from the 70s, or Barbara Steele, who I don't think ever ends up alive at the end of her movies because she's always an evil witch. So I'm going to jump right into the Primitive Observatory and read a few poems. And then at the end of this, I'm going to read a brand new poem from a new manuscript I've pretty recently completed. And I think the only person who's seen it so far is John Glover over there. This first poem I'm going to read is called The Ruin at Drac's End. It's pretty melodramatic, so brace yourselves. Every time Leighton wore the crocodile mask out into the center of the lake, his chief desire was to scream. Instead, he opened the ceramic urn and spread the remains handful by handful until there was nothing left for him. Today he conducted the burial of the late village cooper. Disrespect had brought him shame. He wore on his back the indelible stripes of his father's chastening him for vomiting on the lake shore. The night of that sad episode, his mother had prayed to the lake that she have years enough to see her boy bring up a son who was better. His father had died while asleep, and at dawn, his mother had stripped the bed of the linens and commissioned the pyre builder. Leighton had gathered the ashes, still warm for his first burial. On the water, they had turned to a gray scum, oscillating back and forth on the ripples. His mother had begun to invite young girls to their home for him to court. Over sweet milk and cakes, each one admired the family china, portraits of past crocodiles, and those skeletal shapes of frost on the window panes, asking at last to see the mask and press her lips to it. The Cooper's son had told Leighton that two girls had fought over him. Adrian Sturridge's face was bruised and covered with bite marks. That had come to be gruesomely infected, and the doctor had been forced to shave her head. She had tried twice now to take her own life. The Cooper's son, too, was a bachelor, but had suffered many rejected proposals of marriage. He implored Leighton to take a wife sooner. No beautiful girls would remain in the village. Everybody would respect Leighton's decision regardless. The word of the crocodile was law. It's a shame we don't have Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, here to do commentary between poems. This next poem is similarly melodramatic. It was originally published in Blackbird just this past fall. Thank you, Blackbird. It gives some evidence also of my background in 19th century continental philosophy. This is called 1900 Gibbon Street. Norbert was wont to blame the nosebleeds, too, on his continuing discord with a neighbor in a parallel world. In this house, the boundary between planes thinned almost to transparency. Norbert's first day upon moving here had ended with his blacking out in the bath, and since then, headaches, nausea, and such ills had been making him into a regular invalid. His chief duty, therefore, was to gauge the capacity of the house for serving a malign will. He devoted countless hours to scrutinizing the pastoral scenes printed on the wallpaper in the sitting room, for he had a recurring dream in which he discovered the carpet strewn with offal from a recently butchered elk. When he woke, the air smelled stale and gamey. On account of the cold drafts that the repairman could never locate, he often became fevered, even delirious. In the sitting room, he watched the light from the setting sun through the glass front door burn onto the wall a red portal. His physician had diagnosed a case of nerves and prescribed strong tranquilizers. Yet what protection were dull wits? Everything in this world corresponded to, or was inhabited by, something from another. The door had its shadow door. The sun had its shadow sun. And what might seem a whimsical circuit through this suburb made by Mrs. Loden with her beagle on their evening walk was in reality the signature of an alien intelligence laboring for some purpose. Indeed, was Mrs. Loden human at all? Could it be that she and the beast together were but an image of a hungering nothing, vacuous and weightless as its very concept? Norbert pulled his muffler tight. How best was he to guard himself? Were he ever to leave this house, his tribulations might cease. Or might he himself as easily vanish into oblivion? Or, wherever he went in this world, might he find the same wallpapered room and the same chimera of woman and dog making its paranormal patrol in a remote village of the Klondike with a winter sun that never rose and struck his garret window? He would be no safer. Miners, one after the other, disappeared into an unmapped, frozen wilderness. He would stay where he happened to be, reading Hegel's unfolding of the history of all-consuming Geist through its phenomenological moments of body and mind, servitude and liberty. Something existed so that nothing might also, and vice versa. Between the something and the nothing lay their mutual necessity, a force forever becoming aware. Next, I'm going to read a couple of short pieces that I wrote as interludes for the longer, more narrative poems in this book. I call these nocturnes. This first one I'm going to read is called Craters of the Moon, and I should preface this also by saying that I wrote these when I was sick with the worst flu of my life. Certain people in this room will remember this flu because they attended the same AWP conference. Craters of the Moon. Dear Shadow, for a long time I have lain beside this window, afraid even to move, and still the night must last hours longer, hung from hooks of ice above the frozen reservoir. Those blind fish are not biting. I dreamed that my brother returned here from his grave. At dawn, I said, you will die again. You ought to have stayed where you were under the snow. He is, after all, a white fox with green eyes that see into my dreams. In the crook of my arm he lies and rests his teeth on my throat, as you, Shadow, wait by the door with your bait and trap. I was going to read a different one of those, but I feel like now I really need to read this other one, given that Josh did a broadside for me of the poem. Very unexpected and very nice of him. This one is called Boat at the Wayside. Dear Shadow, I am not alone even now on the abandoned towpath. The moon, broken into pieces, floats on the brook as a night wind shakes free the tangled dry reeds of last year. My breath echoes and dissolves like fog. Should I lie here with the broken moon, or would I only climb out of this cold water shivering? My brother entered the brook long ago, and his mouth was covered with hands of ice. Shadow, you sprawl on the bank and say nothing. Where did the insects go that sang during summer? They died. This next poem is pretty grim, but awfully chipper. The Goat God. In the back room of his shop, the butcher cleaves the last of the morning's carcasses. The dawn is past. In the mews, the child cannot scream, for the procurer's hand covers her mouth. Tonight is the sacrificial augury. The goat god will rise again and breathe into his listener's ears. The bell rings at the shop front, where the servant girls browse hung rabbits and plates of hogsheads and trotters. The butcher wraps their lamb chops in the heavy waxed paper. The girls have come from the east for work serving good households. Daily they do the shopping, wash the clothes and floors, empty and scour the chamber pots. Their lives are built on filth. To the butcher, they might as well come from the top of the world, the frozen wilderness where fools go seeking gold and monsters' tusks. He would cut off both of his thumbs rather than go there. All the people of the east are cold, and their god is nothing but smoke and chiseled stone. Before the open back window, the plucked wings and breasts from 17 geese glisten with fat, gray and purple viscera beside them in the bowl. I'll read one more poem from the Primitive Observatory. This one was also published in Blackbird, and it is one of a pair of poems with the same characters, so if you like these characters, you'll have to purchase a copy of the book to find out more. The Succulent Flowers. In the 43rd dream, Sargent at last was allowed to trade wings of the house with his brother. But Galbraith had left the windows open through the recent storms. Frigate birds were roosting in a wardrobe now overgrown with lichens. As Sargent grabbed their necks, their hollow bones snapped and the splinters pierced his naked fingers. He wiped them on an Easter dress that belonged to their sister Martha, who had gone missing only this year. When Sargent woke, it was 7:30. Galbraith and Martha would have moved on to the greenhouse to supervise the watering. Sargent would skip breakfast and go straight to the study. He would say that he had been awake since dawn and had lost track of time, speculating on the future of glass architecture. In theory, whole cities could be made of glass. Glass walls, glass doors, even roofs of glass. Citizens of glass cities would grow very close. Sargent dried his face beside the washbowl, his burgundy nightshirt saturated with sweat. Their father had always said dreams can kill. Sargent had heard him on the evening of his death from behind his locked chamber door speaking the name of their aunt, Ermelinda. Martha said that dreams were pleasure cruises. One met only nice people, and he conversed or played games on deck, though sometimes the ship sank and he did not live to learn why. So I'm going to read one more poem. This comes from a newly completed manuscript that is even more narrative than the Primitive Observatory. It reads sort of like a novel. It has two interlocking sequences of poems. One of the sequences is even more B-movie-ish than anything you just heard. And it follows this wanderer through a kind of fantasy horror version of Europe as he goes in search of a friend of his. And he goes by the nom de guerre souterrain, which means underground. The dice throwers. The wine flowed. Souterrain would drown if it did not reach an end. And still the Duke spoke of only the hunt. The wild boars, he said, drop like walnuts. The tusks are exceptionally long and beautiful when polished. I will show you the bed that I am having made out of them if ever you come again. So few visit me here in this house. But had it not once been called the Fortress of the Malady? Asked Souterrain. The Duke ordered the glasses filled by the mute with a white mask completely covering his face. All the while, the winds of these lost mountains caused the leaded glass panes set in the walls of the chamber to shudder and groan, and a core of braziers hurled light upon the tapestries that depicted scenes from deep within the annals of history. The massacre of the excommunicants, the siege of Soldak, beheadings of kings whose complex iconographies Souterrain could not with certainty identify. The material had grown dark over numberless decades of dust and soot. At night, the hounds are alert, the Duke said. Indeed, they would die for me if they believed I was in any way threatened. One night, a lynx leaped into the courtyard at the base of this tower in which you and I sit, and try as it might, was unable to escape. The creature, thus bared to the all-seeing eye of the moon, seemed a thing more of light than of flesh. If I had not released the hounds that very moment, they might have torn themselves to shreds. The 18 beasts crowded the floor beneath the dinner table like a king's ransom in carpets. Surely, thought Souterrain, Morneau had been through the past to this country on the utmost edge of the known world. But while oaths were sacred, did the sacred exist in oblivion? Now tell me, said the Duke, if you could do absolutely anything, what would you do? Souterrain started sweating. He would slay a criminal, he said. And would you not, said the Duke, rather forget? I have never myself felt that punitive impulse. Desire, however. If you were simply to desire to do a man harm, I would understand. Again, the mute stoked the braziers in the effort to keep the cold at bay. In this region, the night fell faster and further than Souterrain wished to believe possible. The wine, too, ought to have soothed him. But it tasted unpleasantly bitter, as though made from young, stunted grapes. If he did have a desire of that sort, Souterrain said, what would the Duke like to ask of him next? I, said the Duke, should ask by which method. They are so various. Souterrain selected disemboweling. The massacre of the excommunicants had, yes, involved precisely this, albeit on a grander scale. It was said that the gore had flooded the halls of the abbey in which the monks had attempted to hold shut their wounds, opened by foot soldiers of pious Lord Ruprecht. The Duke smiled. Little would please me so much as to offer you this man whom you seek, he said. Already I think of you as one might a son, and I would watch proudly as you spilled his guts, and the stench of prey rose into the air and embraced us. On a golden charger between Souterrain and the Duke, the crowned rack of lamb lay ruined in a pool of fat and juices. The mute stood with his back to the feast at the black windows, and his mask appeared to float, bodiless, outside in the frozen night, where the cold, mirrored fires burned. Souterrain could almost smell blood as the clouds parted, and for an instant exposed a silvered theater of dead battlements and crags. And beyond the last of the high peaks, nothing.
Thank you.
That was wonderful, Gregory. Congratulations. There are few things that feel better than seeing someone you've worked with in a program and on various projects with succeed. So that's very happy. It's a great night for all of us. I can't lay claim to any of Allison's success, but I have been happy to know her for over 10 years. She's one of my favorite people in Richmond. I came to VCU after she had graduated, but her name was still echoing through the halls as wonderfully multifaceted writer. I mean, she is the definition of a writer who can take on just about anything. She's a wonderful poet and a fantastic novelist. She can write experimentally, but in a way that's accessible to people who still like plot-driven stories. And she sets new challenges with every piece of work she writes, and she meets those challenges for herself. And of course, you know the list of her achievements because you've read the flyer. But she has written two poetry collections, Some of Every Lost Ship and The True Book of Animal Homes, which is forthcoming and I'm looking forward to very much. And the workshop now is enjoying her novel, The Arsonist's Song Has Nothing to Do with Fire. Her recent work has appeared in A Public Space, Boston Review, Blackbird, Gulf Coast, Tin House, and I'm going to make her promise to give me something for my magazine, Broad Street. Still haven't managed to wrench it out of her yet. She co-edits the poetry journal Handsome, and she got one of the swanky fellowships from the NEA in 2011. The Arsonist's Song Has Nothing to Do with Fire is a real tour de force, which in book reviewing circles can sometimes mean a bag of gimmicks and sometimes a wonderful display of technique that surprises you on every page. Allison pulls off stylistic pyrotechnics in a story that's about death, possessions, and possibilities with a little bit of a detective story thrown in. It shows an expanding aesthetic and the same dexterity with language that is also the hallmark of her poetry. Her style is by turns lyrically oblique and traditionally specific, and it creates a visceral experience that can make any reader, experimental, traditional, feel along with the characters and maybe even feel that special magic to which writers always aspire. Reading her work is a beautiful and harrowing experience. The sensory evocations in her poems, for example, leave lingering traces in your mind and body. With moss and rotten apples and cigarettes, each chapter or poem is really felt. And as one poem conclusively tells us, nothing feels safe any longer. Especially not with the arsonist running around. Every page gets a little star in the margin or some other highlight to remind the reader to return and reflect. But perhaps the most important thing to know about Allison is this. She really is the person she seems to be in her writing. She is funny, brilliant, smart, quick, generous, full of boundless potential, and she loves her pugs. It makes me really happy when good people succeed, so I am very happy to introduce Allison Titus.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for having me. Thank you to Suzanne for that really generous introduction. I thought I'd read a tiny bit from the novel and then some newish poems. I hope that's okay. The novel, I should say a few things. It features three main characters. There's a doctor who wants to build human wings. It was based on a real person. There's an arsonist who becomes the doctor's assistant, Ronnie. And there's Vivian who lives in strangers' houses. Vivian is estranged from her mentally ill mother, who has lived in self-imposed exile in like rural Nebraska for years. And she also is obsessed with her own death. So she makes up weird obituaries that are like standalone chapters, and they're signaled by dates. I'll read one of those. In the section I'll read, Vivian has just learned that her mother's died, and she needs to go to Nebraska to take care of things, and Ronnie has convinced her to let him take her. It's going to take like 12 hours. He pretends it's going to take less. And on the way, he confesses to her that he's working for this strange doctor and that the doctor has this weird plan. They were an hour and a half out by then, and Vivian was asleep. The night continued, The AM radio voices continued. The dark road continued, past fields sheen stiff with frost and bordered by the shallow ditches that sloped for miles beneath the moonlit banks. About a quarter mile before they would head southwest, switching over to Highway 5, Ronnie veered down the access road to the truck stop. An enormous neon green sign in the shape of a tire, ampersand, and spoon was hoisted 30 feet into the sky on a steel pole. Ronnie parked next to a camper and turned off the car. The lot was packed with trucks. "What time is it?" Vivian said, not opening her eyes. She didn't move, still folded under the coat. "Not as late as it feels," he said. "Feels like 4 a.m, she said. She squinted her eyes open but stayed where she was. "Not even 11:30, Ronnie said. "Do you mind stopping here? Half an hour, is that?" "Yeah," she said, "it's fine." They settled at a booth in the corner. The suitcase brown vinyl of the seats peeled away and slinty patches of cushion shoving through. The table had a series of permanent coffee rings, 30 years worth of truckers drinking black cup after black cup on their mandatory off duty. Through the window, they could see a bank of rented rooms behind the restaurant. Biblical crosswords were stacked in the revolving magazine rack, along with manuals called One Year to Savior, 365 Sermons, and gilt-edged Bibles, many King James versions, and large print New Testaments. They sold speed there, too. It was a weird vibe, the low-key desperation mixed with mildly seedy undertones and righteousness. Edith, the waitress, brought them coffee and took Ronnie's order. Vivian still had no appetite, but when Edith brought Ronnie's plate, she put a bowl of soup in front of Vivian anyway. Edith had piercing eyes, made more prominent below a wide forehead undecorated by bangs, her blonde hair wisped off her face by a pink plastic clip. Her face was pleasant, her smile an expanse of goldenrod fleshing out a drab meadow, and despite the deep creases under her lower lids, she looked deceptively youthful. "Now I know you need something, sweetheart, so I brought some soup. You could use it, I can tell." Edith winked at them and Viv nodded, and Ronnie thought how she looked like a mess right then, yet her face in sadness was even more lovely than her regular face. Her coalish eyes turned brighter and darker against her pale skin, and her normally sharp features were a little puffy from crying. Vivian stiffly held her spoon, making no move to eat. When Edith came by a few minutes later with the warm-up coffee, Vivian drew the spoon to her mouth, swallowed, and caught Edith's eye. Edith smiled, "Good," she said, and left Ronnie's coffee steaming at the brim. They sat in silence. Ronnie sipped coffee. Viv pushed her soup around with her spoon. Ronnie remembered again that he needed to call the doctor because he wouldn't be showing up the next morning. Vivian gave him a funny look, and he paused with his cup mid-distance to the table. And then she was standing up, pushing away from the booth and hurrying to the back, headed toward the ladies' room, the swing door swinging after her. Ronnie didn't know what to do, how long to wait before going after her. He didn't want to overreact and didn't want to underreact, so he sat there. Minutes passed and no Vivian. Edith stopped at the table. "Well, she was in such a hurry. Should I go check on her for you, dear?" She shrugged at the calm room, maybe 12 travelers left, but nearly everyone tucked into their meals or smoking. "It's slow," she said. "Just sit tight." Ronnie tapped his lighter on the edge of the table, waiting. He watched a driver on the other side of the room who was playing both sides of a travel chess game. There was something else. There was one thing, one part of it Ronnie hadn't told Vivian, back in the car. Not really about the wings, maybe, but somehow related. He had discovered a small safe a few days earlier, when he'd stayed at work late. Ronnie had been in the alcove, photocopying an article on dirigibles, when he noticed something jutting out from the wall. A panel that wasn't flush at one corner. He'd pried it open with his keys. What he found inside was a small fireproof box containing old pictures of freak show and sideshow performers, each one, man, woman, child, half-child, awkwardly pivoted under the scaffolding of wings that appeared to sprout from the blades of their shoulders. Flyers for exhibitions of rarities and cabinet cards circa 1880 of an albino girl named Ida, whose one arm was not an arm but a crumpled, hairless, featherless stretch of muscle that resembled the wing of a skinned chicken. He took one of the flyers. It said, "Luminous sensitives, come see firsthand." Ronnie kept it, shut the lid, closed the safe, turned out the lights. December 7, 1989. "Shalt such fever ever last? what lonesome horizon to ignite. Done with twilights that brim with thrushes. Done with cold calls. Done with formalities. Done with potlucks. Done with expenditure reports and standard operating procedures. Done with situation rooms. Done with pundits. Done with hardcore. Done with illustrated guides. Out on the frozen Baden River, the ice boat skims the clean white scale of erasure, the absence of horizon, the expanse. There is white, and there is white so white it is blue. Almost like science, how it happened. The chronological reductions, precautions taken against some fierce army's approach. How she started wearing gloves, refusing to touch anything barehanded. Newsprint, doorknobs, loose change. Long white gloves that fastened just below the elbow with a single pearled button, hook and eye. She had one pair and every other day washed them in the sink, hands folded on her lap while she waited for them to dry, or socks pulled over her fingers like mittens. When Vivian asked her mother why she wore the gloves, she said, "If you touch something, they know where you've been. It's so easy how they can find you. No prints, no trace." She sounded to Vivian like an actor hired to portray a criminal on TV who was still learning her lines. When Vivian asked, "Who are they?" her mother said, "All of them." How, a few months before her mother quit that job at the makeup counter of the only department store within city limits, she brought home cans of rice and beans and peaches and bottles of seltzer and olives and jars of cashews. She filled the pantry, all the cupboards, the hallway closets, and the bedroom closets. She stashed the food under the beds and on the laundry room shelves. For weeks, she stockpiled whatever the daily discount was. Soap, artichoke hearts, canisters of wheat germ. Then she quit her job and quit, therefore, leaving the house. She was full of reasons to stay home, to stay inside and prepare for the day they rang the doorbell, the group of them, whoever they were, whatever they wanted, to repo her middle-aged Pontiac. Maybe they weren't even people. Maybe what was after her was a darker force. Once during that season, Vivian came home from junior high, a Thursday, impending snow, the gray afternoon thick with cold, heavy with it, to find that her mother had changed the locks on the door. She tried her key 6 times, 7 times. She rang the doorbell, she knocked, then kicked the door until finally Seth let her in. Her mother ignored the commotion. Vivian found her in her room, hunched near the window, holding a shortwave radio. The radio was loud, crackling and roaring like wind. Vivian remembered gripping the threshold to keep her balance, feeling like she might pass out. "What's going on?" she'd said. "Quick, Vivian," her mother whispered. "This is the best place to hear." Her speech was rushed and declarative. Vivian felt every molecule of her body congregating, rallying against the insanity of her mother crouched there on the floor in sweatpants and blouse and delicate white gloves, staving off whatever doom she was convinced was arriving. Vivian could not move. She stood there, staring and suffocating somewhere inside, someplace hot and nameless. She couldn't remain, couldn't help, couldn't muster the faith of deciding where to begin. No wonder Seth stopped speaking. "You changed the locks," Vivian said eventually. "I know," her mother said, breathless. "I had to. They gave me no choice," she said. "They're almost here." She touched the window with one gloved hand, like she was waving to someone she knew was out there but couldn't see. Vivian felt sick remembering, sitting there in the stall, her head in her hands. She wondered how long she'd been in there. She'd thrown up in the toilet and instead of feeling better, felt lightheaded, so she sat down with her head bent to her knees and counted to 100 twice. When Edith swung through the door, Vivian was staring at the graffiti in her stall. PTL driver Carl Skinner is a... "Excuse me, hello?" It sounded like she sat down on the ledge of the sink, a creaking under new weight sound. PTL driver Carl Skinner is a lying. "You all right in there? Your friend wanted me to check and see are you all right. Is it your stomach? Do you need anything? There's aspirin at the desk. The truckers always ask for it." PTL driver Carl Skinner is a lying cocksucker. Vivian gingerly stood up, smoothed her tights and straightened her skirt where it bunched up over her knees. She opened the door and went to the other sink. "It's okay," she said, running the water as cold as it got, holding her wrists under the faucet until she felt calm and sober. The water was too loud to talk over. Edith examined her fingers, chipping pink polish onto the counter nail by nail. Vivian watched Edith in the mirror. She was not old-looking, but she seemed archaic in that pinafore and name tag, and Vivian would not have been surprised if she'd worked that truck stop for 35 years by now. And what griefs had rearranged their habits in Edith's life? Was she divorced? Was she widowed? Did she rent an apartment, eat dinner in front of syndicated The Love Connections? Did she put every tip in the jar on her dresser thinking Florida? Well, Edith said when the water was off, you sure got out of there fast, sweetheart. She said sure, like shore, and Vivian pictured it that way, a blue wavery expanse rolling open between them, breaking the bathroom sinks apart and drifting them away from each other in big waves. What is it, hon? You look like something spooked you now, Edith said. Vivian shook her head, more to clear it of the breaking waves she pictured closing in on them. I think I just need some water, Viv said. She thought about saying it. My mother died yesterday, and the last time she talked to me was 7 years ago, but she couldn't bring herself to impose on Edith. You're sure now? Vivian nodded. She wanted to know if Edith had kids, and if her mother was still alive, and if they talked on the phone. Well, I can take care of that. You come along when you're ready, I'll tell your friend. And she swung out the door, and Vivian leaned on the sink for a minute more because the swinging door was loud and the way it knocked back and forth made her dizzy. She didn't want to think anymore. 2 hours down, 11 more to go. Ronnie had lied. It was farther away than Vivian thought. Okay, poem time. This is called All the Real Girls, after a movie called All the Real Girls by David Gordon Green, which has a soft spot in my heart, and I just recently rewatched, which means this is probably too soon to read to anybody. All the Real Girls. It's about young love. It's about a small southern town, the kind where there's always cars to fix, and a couch in the field where the teens go to smoke and throw rocks, and through the scrub of trees there's a gouge of middle blue most days. A three-legged dog hobbles by on two. Shift ends, the mill workers step out into the breeze, against their shirt-sleeved arms into the open mouth of the summer night, pat down their pockets for cigarettes or keys. There's a refurbished piano in the tall grass. Now and then someone plays. I think from everything I'm saying, you can tell what I mean, that it's tough, but it's also tender, this life and its unfolding. And no way is there a better girl around than the one played by a baby-faced Zooey Deschanel, who returns from boarding school with a heart like a racehorse sprinting for the miracle finish. I won't give away what happens, but I want to tell you about the scene where the cool guy begrudgingly dresses up like a clown as a favor to his mother, played by Patricia Clarkson, and performs for a group of children at the local hospital. The whole scene of syncopation and jutting elbows plays out over Apocalypso by Mazinga Phaser, what I'm going to describe as elegiac space rock, though I'm lousy at knowing what music is or isn't made of. It's upbeat, it's shivery, and the clowns basically do an interpretive dance that feels not at all appropriate slash cheerful. The room is swathed in green and yellow, the color of parachutes or bright balloons. But there's a single moment at the very end where the cool guy looks dead at the camera and scowls, like he's breaking character, like he's really disgusted by the fact of his performance, how he had to put on a dumb, colorful suit and act bonkers for the length of a song, even though the room is full of sick kids, pale and waifish kids, and he's forgotten what it means to be able to walk out the revolving doors when the song ends, to walk out into the sunshine of the parking lot and straight into a day that might, if you're lucky, let you take off your jacket down by the river and in the loud trance of rapids sit and skip stones and think how maybe this is all you get after all, just some water and some sunlight and some trees and some rocks. And isn't it really something of a miracle, this business of just staying alive? The rest of these are mostly about animals and crying. Essay on Economies of Scale. Mid-morning they arrive. I'm at the grocery fingering cellophane tucked slick to the iceberg lettuce as the summer school kids trade cigarettes and sleeping pills down at the pipeline. It's mid-morning and late afternoon and another day. First tomatoes ripening by the fistful. It's early July when they arrive dusty, arrive heat-stroked, arrive like so many boxes of catalytic converters, and the day splits open, squeal and prodded, day dragged forth. When the phone rings and it's no one, while I'm waiting for an oil change at the service station. as daylight wanes and fireflies lamp the backyard, as the heat wave stretches into a third week and the city's power goes out, goes on, flickers again when the storm comes. They arrive grimed to cages and trucks stuffed to capacity, delivery distribution problem solved. Thursday morning and any morning and daily and weekly and 10:30. This morning on the kill floor, the piglet tried to nuzzle the worker. Like a puppy, the worker says, it happens all the time. And by then the international flight is canceled. And by then the library books are overdue. And by then the new pop songs have replaced the new pop songs. And by then, like two ships passing. And by then the petition has been circulated. And by then the signatures pending. And by then we are all dolled up. And by then we have gone dancing. And by then the raffles ended and a man has won the Sebring. And by then the GDP. And by then the private sector benefits. And by then per capita. And by then the joke doesn't land. And by then dinner's ready. And by then the season coming on. And by then the committees gathering. And the committees all forming ghost committees. And the TV shows starting up again. Essay on Endurance. Are you animal then? Are you gallop, scape of fringe cup, and wood sorrel, and sweet after death? Are you rove the pines? Are you plush the thicket? Body goes in a flash, in a fever, in a rush, scrapping. Body goes all this time. Goes hooked to the ache and season standing in the pits. Junk carnival long gone, just the outskirts, then the outskirts around that. What kingdom of death is this? To heave in the dust of the outfield, the loose split, we surplus and hostage the meat of your plenty. No name electric, harness and shackle. All those summers, body left to one creature. The dig and gnaw of waiting was a plague. Nobody came, nobody came. Essay on Professional Weepers. Anyway, what do you owe the politician of the gaze cast down? Remorse clasped to your throat like a locket full of bees. Some terrible hour on a Saturday, heels sinking divots in the soft grass, a measured green. Everybody hanging on for dear life. And this is the last poem, it's called Vibrant Matter. The first, best, perfect remedy, a slate, a salve, a wound of spent stars for the suture. The wreckage collects inside, rabbiting the rabbit in all of us, little by little adding up to something feral. Tonight at the bar, the chalkboard over our heads says bone marrow cake is the dessert of the day, and I get it. The point is to devour to oblivion our fetish. Isn't it wild, this disease, how it glows, almost nuclear at the source? How we take every chance we get to glow brighter than the brightest thing we can get our hands on. The first chance we get, every chance we get, closer to how it glows almost nuclear at the source. If there was a way, at least, to see by the light of it spilling out. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.